This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. Psychic phenomena, also known as psi or parapsychology, is the study of consciousness with respect to telepathy, precognition, clairvoyance, psychokinesis, near-death experiences, as well as reincarnation and apparitional experiences. And on the phone with me today, Dr. Dean Radin, he's a chief scientist of the Institute of Noetic Sciences. We're discussing the taboo of parapsychology, or what we refer to as psi phenomena. Welcome to the show, and thank you for talking to us, Dr. Dean.
Thank you for asking me.
You went from being a professional violinist to an electrical engineer and finally a researcher in psi phenomena after completing a PhD in psychology. What sort of provoked you to make such drastic changes in your career path?
Well, it does sound like a drastic change, I suppose, but think of how many people are interested in this topic. Surveys around the world show that roughly 60% of the population is interested because of personal experiences of telepathy or precognition. And another large chunk of the population, perhaps another 20%, are interested because they know someone who's had these experiences. So that's a very large percentage of the population. And I'm like anyone else. I've heard these stories as a scientist and wondered, could those stories be true? So very early in my career, even when I was in graduate school, I had started to do experiments and read the literature of parapsychology, and I discovered to my surprise that there was much more evidence for these phenomena than I had previously thought. And more importantly, when I ran experiments myself, that I was able to get results which suggested that some of these phenomena are actually true. So it piqued my interest, and I've remained interested for the past almost 30 years now.
Is parapsychology all about science, Dr. Dean? Because there's also history, literature, philosophy, as well as religious studies that can provide some sort of contribution to the field. So do you look at it in totality, or is it all about the science?
Well, it's a very good question, because certainly much of our religious and mystical literature is saturated with stories about psychic phenomena. So it's important to include the scholarly aspects of these legends in some case and stories in others. It's also important to include the psychological components of why people, in some cases they're probably delusional, in other cases they may be real. My interest as a scientist is in studying the nature of the phenomena under controlled conditions, because there we have the possibility of seeing whether the effects that people report are true in principle. And that's really the key. If the effects are true in principle, we can see them under controlled conditions. That puts a very different understanding on how we would address the scholarly literature and religious lore and that sort of thing.
What are your religious views and thoughts on spirituality, and does it sort of affect your research?
I don't subscribe to any religion. Mm-hmm. I was brought up Jewish, but not religiously, and I don't practice any religion now. I guess the closest that I would say is I'm agnostic. I don't know what's true in a religious sense, so that doesn't really influence my interest at all. My interest is really driven by curiosity, and oftentimes people will think that either I have had psychic phenomena happen to me or to my close family members, and that's not the case either. Mm-hmm. Actually, when I was growing up, no one ever even talked about this topic. Mm-hmm. But I encountered it all the time in science fiction and fairy tales and in mythology. And I always wondered, like many people do, well, I wonder if these are just stories or if it's reflecting something that's true.
Right. So when you adopt this psychicness, for the lack of a better word, is it something that everyone has the ability to develop, or is it just, they call it the sixth sense sometimes. Is there a distinction between the two?
I would say that given everything that we know at this point from a scientific perspective, that these phenomena or these abilities appear in the same frequency and in the same way as musical talent or sports talent. that if we were to try to figure out in advance whether a baby was going to be talented in sports or music, the best prediction of that is what were the parents. Well, the same seems to hold in the case of psychic phenomena. Oftentimes it seems to run in families. Mm-hmm. What we don't know yet is whether there is an identifiable genetic component or whether it runs in families, because some families tend to be more open to these phenomena than others.
Right.
But what we can tell from the laboratory tests, which almost always involve people who don't make special claims, most of them being college students who are doing the experiments because that's part of their career, mm-hmm. in college, we can say that these phenomena are distributed in very much the same way as people's ability to play golf.
Right.
In which case, most people can play a little bit with some instruction, but a small percentage are very talented and they can do much better than others.
Right. And let's face it, Dr. Dean, the science of parapsychology has a fundamental evidence problem. How do you circumvent this and, you know, convince people that it isn't the case?
Well, evidence in terms of science has to do with repeatability of experimental results. And it's true that up to about 20 years ago, it was very difficult to make the case that the experiments that we run have been repeated independently by independent labs, because mm-hmm. that's really that's the currency of proof in science. But starting around 20 years ago, new techniques were developed, not just in parapsychology, but in basically all of the behavioral and medical sciences, and they're called meta-analysis. And this is a way of testing quantitatively if the effects observed in one laboratory are the same as other laboratories. So this meta-analysis method has been applied to the literature in parapsychology to see whether, for example, whether telepathy tests have been significantly repeated. And the answer is yes. And what's even more interesting is that the nature of these analyses, the nature of the experiments, have reached a level of precision now and repeatability that these studies, the meta-analyses and the experiments, are published in mainstream psychological journals and also in physics journals and in neuroscience journals. Mm-hmm. So 20 years ago, it's true, it would have been difficult to make this case. Now it is much, much easier because of the nature of analyzing multiple experiments, and that's reflected by these studies now appearing in the peer-reviewed literature.
What are the applications of some of these findings?
Well, I think from a scientific perspective, we don't know. From a basic science perspective, the question that's been asked so far is, do the phenomena exist? It appears that they do. Mm-hmm. The second one is, how can we explain how they work, which is about theory development, and we're lagging far behind on that. Mm-hmm. And only after those two are pretty well established do people start thinking about application. But that said, we know, for example, that the U.S. government for 20 years was supporting a classified program where highly trained and highly talented psychics were using a form of clairvoyance that they called remote viewing for espionage. Mm-hmm. So that's one possible use. If you can gain information from a distance, then it could be useful in that term.
Yeah,
in those terms.
You want to tell me more about the work that you were, did with the? It was a classified program investigating psychic phenomena for the U.S. government. Can you just tell me a little bit more about that?
Well, this was a program that started around 1972 mm-hmm. and ended in the mid 1990s. It was classified. It was two components, one of which was research, which is the part that I was on, to look at various kinds of psychic phenomena, mostly having to do with clairvoyance. First of all, to confirm whether or not it was true, and second, to see if we could find people who are very talented in it, to study the nature of it. How does it work, and could it be blocked, and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. You want to just explain, before you go on, what clairvoyance really is? Maybe give me an example.
Clairvoyance is a perception that is not bounded or constrained by the ordinary senses. So it typically would involve gaining information from a distance mm-hmm. that is beyond the reach of the ordinary senses. So that's a distance in space, but it can also be a distance in time. So we think of perception through time typically as precognition, meaning information from the future, but it could also be retrocognition. It could be gaining information from the past that you don't have an ordinary way of getting.
Right.
So that's the nature of the phenomenon. So as I said, part of the research program is to figure out what is it, how does it work, can you make it better? And the second part was applications, and the applications were almost entirely on espionage.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, whenever you do any form of espionage, you don't rely on any single source. And in this case, the remote viewing, as they called it, was one channel of information, which was then combined with many other channels in order to make a decision.
The skeptic community is strong. They're vocal. Do you blame people for having doubts in the work that you do?
No, not at all. In fact, from a science perspective, you have to be skeptical about any unusual claim. It's part of the core approach that science takes, and it's one of the reasons why science is so strong. So we expect and actually welcome skeptical comments and criticisms, but sometimes skepticism it takes off into a wrong turn, and it stops being skeptical, because after all, skepticism is really just about doubt, and there's nothing wrong with doubt. But sometimes skeptics get to the point where they're actually no longer doubting, and they get more into a mode where they deny. And that's not healthy for science, because if the moment that you begin to deny evidence, especially experimental evidence, then it's not science anymore. Mm-hmm. It becomes dogmatic. So one of the things that has really benefited parapsychology over the years are skeptics from outside the field and inside the field who have repeatedly said, well, have you thought of this loophole or that problem? And this had made the experiments that we use today extremely rigorous. In fact, more rigorous than in many conventional disciplines because of this level of scrutiny. So it has been very useful.
When we come back, we'll find out more about the psi phenomenon with Dean Radin. He's a chief scientist at the Institute of Noetic Sciences. Up next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon and welcome back. It is The Bigger Picture. We're trying to break down the taboos related to parapsychology. I know in this country, at least, half of us probably believe in it, half of us probably don't. But, you know, and nobody quite understands or can explain the science behind all of this. But on the line with me, Chief Scientist of the Institute of Noetic Sciences in California, Dr. Dean Radin. He's telling me more about whether or not these things, these so-called things, really exist. I mean, can you tell me, how would you convince me, Dr. Dean? I mean, I'm a skeptic. Don't quite believe that these things happen. How would you convince me?
Well, the way when I talk to audiences, typically we'll ask how many people have had an experience that I might describe as a gut feeling, a visceral sensation in the gut that tells you something's not quite right, and then sure enough, it seems to be an alert of something in the future. Or perhaps a precognitive dream. You wake up and you have a sense of something, and during the day it unfolds. Or you pick up the phone, and without even looking at it, you somehow know who's on the other end of the line. So the other very common one is the feeling of being stared at. So these are phenomena which may or may not have a psychic component, but they're very common. Something like 70 to 80% of people will have one or more of these kinds of experiences. They're not very dramatic, but they do suggest that occasionally we may get information that is not just subliminal. It's not noticing without paying attention to it, but actually coming at you in an unusual way. So most of the experiments in parapsychology have taken advantage of the stories that people talk about and figured out a way to put it under controlled conditions so you can very cleanly exclude ordinary explanations. So if I describe to you something like a telepathy experiment, mm-hmm. it takes a little while to go through the design and the results of one experiment, the results of hundreds of experiments, the way that criticisms have been proposed to explain the results and the responses generally takes something like 20 minutes to go through even one experiment. So it's not something that I could explain in just a few moments. It requires either a much longer time to explain how experiments work, mm-hmm. or recommendation to read a book or books that I've written or articles. That's the way that I would usually approach that question.
Right. I remember my grandmother saying, and as a Hindu, she'd say, if you do in fact feel uncomfortable or, you know, you feel something's not terribly right, she would say, just recite one of the Hindu mantras, and if you concentrate hard enough on it, you'll be all right. Did she have any basis for saying that? Or does that really work?
Oh, well, it probably would work in the sense of a pure psychological sense. Mm-hmm. In other words, that if you simply become calm and you will withdraw from anxiety and you'll feel better. And, of course, reciting a mantra is a meditation, and that would make your body calm and your mind will follow. Mm-hmm. So that may well work. I'm a meditator myself, so I think I understand that if you're feeling anxious and you go into a meditative state, the anxiety quickly goes away. Mm-hmm. But, of course, that has nothing to do with being psychic, but it nevertheless, it still works.
You have frauds on one side and the debunkers on the other, and you're in the middle, still trying to do science. Is there a way around this?
Well, as you said, you recognize that there absolutely are frauds who mm-hmm. take advantage of people's beliefs on one side.
Yep.
There are people who are very energetically trying to debunk the frauds, and I applaud them for doing that. Mm-hmm. But there's always a middle ground. In this case, the underlying question for me is, could some of these experiences really be true? And sometimes the way that the debunkers will portray this is that the only people who have these experiences or report them are uneducated or superstitious or something like that.
Or weak. That's something.
Yeah,
that's
weak, and that, you know, that psychologically they can't handle the world. But the fact is that I guess because of the position that I'm in as a scientist, one of not that many in the world who is studying this, I know that there are many, many college professors in psychology and medicine, physics, who contact me and tell me about their interest. And once I get to know them better, they tell me story after story mm-hmm. of very powerful psychic experiences that they're at a loss to explain. And for many of these people, these are highly educated. The psychologists are very well aware of all of the frailties of the human mind and ways that we can fool each other and ourselves. And they know that it's not that. It's something else. Something else happened. And that's why they contact me, trying to understand from a science perspective, what is it? How do we understand these things? So I don't buy the story of the debunker who says that 100% of these effects are fraud. Mm-hmm. That I'm convinced that that's not the case, not only because of our experiments, which are done under rigorous conditions and then published later in peer-reviewed journals, but rather all of that combined with people who are in a position to be able to know the difference between a delusion and a confabulation and something that was real. And even all beyond that, there are some cases where people have an experience that turns out to be so powerful for them that it's literally life-transforming. They become a different person as a result of an experience. One very typical example is that somebody wakes up at 3 o'clock in the morning, and at the foot of the bed they see an apparition of the grandmother, mm-hmm. and then they learn the next day that she had just died. So I've heard this from several of my colleagues, all of whom are college professors. They oftentimes won't tell anybody the story, and they only tell me because I know them for a while.
Yep.
And it clearly made a huge impact on them because they may not have thought about this stuff at all beforehand. But when the event occurs, they can't deny their own experience or the coincidence in finding out that the grandmother had just died. And that sparks their curiosity, and they want to know how is that even possible.
This may be a far-fetched question, but after all the science you've done over the last 30 years, what really happens after death? and what would have brought about the aberration of grandma sitting at the foot of your bed?
Well, it's a very good question, and so far it's not one that's resolved. There are people who have near-death experiences who would say that some aspect of their personality persists and their awareness persists. From what we know about psychic phenomena at this point, there actually is no clear answer about what happens after you die. There's a way to interpret the evidence suggesting that some form of awareness persists, but whether personality exists is completely open. We actually don't know at all if personality will continue to exist after the body dies. And this is because at this point we don't actually know for sure where memory resides. If memory resides in the brain or in the body, and the body dies, then if anything persists after the body goes away, it's not going to know that it's you, mm-hmm. because you are your memory. Whereas if some aspect of memory is not in the body, then there's a possibility that something about what you call yourself, which involves awareness and memory, then yourself may indeed persist. But we don't know what the answer is yet.
The actual academic study of parapsychology seemingly disappeared since its heyday in the mid-20th century. What happened?
Well, it subsided. Certainly in the United States it subsided, but there seems to be an equilibration process in that as it was declining in the United States, it was increasing in the United Kingdom. So as of now, there's roughly 50 to 70 PhDs in England and at least a dozen universities where there are professors whose primary research interest is parapsychology. Mm-hmm. That legacy came from the University of Edinburgh in Scotland, which has an endowed chair of parapsychology. And it was through that program that many people around the world went through it, got their PhD, and now many are in England, many are scattered around the world, and they're continuing their interests. So while this still is pretty much of a taboo topic within the United States, it's much less so in the United Kingdom. And you can also find professors pursuing this topic in Europe. Actually, in every country, you can find some people who are pursuing this. But I would say that the center of gravity in terms of academic centers now is England primarily.
Are there career prospects in this field, or does it rest purely in science?
Well, career in the sense of a professorship, yes, in the academic world. Mm-hmm. Career in terms of independent research institutes, probably not. I can think of me and perhaps four or five other people in the world who are working full-time as researchers in research institutes. So as a career, then, it's not a very good choice.
Do you think the psi phenomena has become disorganized, underfunded, and in the realm of traditional science, it's largely ignored?
Well, yes and no. Yes, in the sense that if you look at the total amount of money that is used to support science around the world, it's probably hundreds of billions of dollars, of which very close to zero goes to parapsychology. So in that sense, yes, from a mainstream perspective, it is clearly not on the map. On the other hand, there are roughly half a dozen foundations around the world. There's one in Portugal. There are some small ones in the United Kingdom. There are a few in the United States who explicitly give money for research in this topic. So the total amount of money is not that much. It's not like the amount that governments give. But there's always been a continuing interest in this field. I would say there's growing interest in parapsychology primarily because of publications that are appearing now in mid to top tier journals. And of course, science pays a lot of attention to, and should pay attention to, peer-reviewed journal articles. Well, there is a slow but continual influx of journal articles, and that brings it to the attention of scientists. And like anyone else, half of them are going to be very interested in the topic, so they'll pay attention.
Are these journals well accepted by the mainstream scientific community?
Well, I'm talking about mainstream journals, mm-hmm. Journals in psychology that are considered top tier, journals in physics, journals in neuroscience. I mean, yes. So these are journals that publish studies that have nothing to do with psychic phenomena. And so some barriers are being broken slowly. I created a web page that lists journals, journal articles that have been published that include some of the mainstream journals. Yes.
Isn't there a lot of room for abuse as far as parapsychology is concerned? Especially, you know, where majority of the people do not even believe in the psi phenomena.
Well, the majority of people do believe. So the question is, abuse of whom? If it's people taking advantage of other people's beliefs, well, yes, there's always that possibility, and it's reprehensible.
And it happens.
Sure, it happens. So and actually many countries have laws against this kind of fraud, mm-hmm. and their people are arrested and charged with fraud if that's the case. But that's very different than the question that is of interest in science. From the science perspective, we want to know, is it ever true? It's very similar to the saying, well, if it's possible to commit fraud in the financial world, will anybody do that? Well, the answer is obviously yes. Mm-hmm. But does that mean that everything in the financial world is fraudulent? Well, obviously no.
Yeah.
The same could be said here, that yes, people will take advantage of other people's beliefs, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it's all fraud. And so I'm interested in the real stuff and not the fraudulent stuff.
Right. Do you think you'll find those answers even in this lifetime?
Well, answers to what? One possible question is, are any of these phenomena true?
Yes.
Do they really exist?
Mm-hmm.
I think I do have answers to that, and most of my colleagues would agree.
Yeah.
Well, we have answers to explain. That's a much more difficult question, to explain how these effects work. That I don't know if I'll live to see that day. But I'm reasonably confident that if research continues, eventually we will understand it, yes.
Do you think this psychic phenomena would become mainstream soon or, you know, soon enough?
Well, soon, probably not. Soon in historical time, meaning perhaps 50 years or 100 years, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, at some point, it won't, you know, now it has the sheen of being supernatural, supernormal. That will go away. And the history of science shows very clearly that phenomena come up that are unexplained, and people initially act in a very reactive way to it. You know, they will look at lightning and say it's the anger of the gods. Well, time moves on, people figure out how things work, and we no longer view lightning as the anger of the gods. In the same way, eventually someone will have a telepathic experience and will no longer see it as spooky. We'll simply see it as an aspect of something like deep physics or something of that sort.
If we're interested to read more of this evidence in mainstream journals, what are some of the reliable websites that we should go to, Dr. Dean?
Well, one good place to start is my own website, which is deanradin.com.
Mm-hmm.
And another is the website of the Parapsychological Association, which is parapsych.org.
Okay. And you're going to be here in Malaysia for the ECLIF conference. You want to tell me what you'll be presenting?
I'm going to talk about some of the content in my new book, which is called Supernormal.
Mm-hmm.
And the title is Science, Yoga, and the Evidence for Extraordinary Psychic Abilities. So part of the idea here is that there are many mystical and esoteric traditions that talk about the arising of psychic abilities as the result of dedicated meditative practice. So I take this as a claim. Here's the claim that you do yoga in a certain way and you achieve samadhi and you create cities. And I mean, these are all Sanskrit terms that basically say that if you meditate long enough in the correct way, you will develop these abilities.
Mm-hmm.
So I looked in detail at the kinds of abilities that traditional yoga says would occur, and analyze, based on the experimental evidence, do any of those seem to be true? And so I'm going to talk about the results of what I found as in looking at both the legends about these abilities and what the experiments say about them.
Thank you for speaking with me.
You're very welcome.
The Leadership Energy Summit Asia will be held from the 3rd to the 4th of December. If you'd like more information, just log on to ecliff.org/LESA. Dr. Din Radin, Chief Scientist of the Institute of Noetic Sciences, on the taboos of parapsychology or the psi phenomena on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.